Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show, here on the Liberty Radio Network. Appreciate you tuning in. Ray McGovern's going to be here today to talk about Russia and America and Obama. And Kelly B. Vallejos will be back on the show as well. She's got one for the American Conservative magazine about Afghanistan I would like to talk to her about. So that's coming up here in a little while. I'm still waiting to hear back on one or two more, but not so sure how that's going to work. But that's all right. I'm actually happy to have a little bit extra free time on the show today because I got a lot of news to cover. Got a lot of things that I want to say. First, though, before I say the things I want to say, I'll say the things I have to say. Go to my website, scotthorton.org. Sign up for the podcast feeds. Join up the chat room during the show. That's scotthorton.org/chat. Check out the archives going all the way back to 2003 at scotthorton.org/interviews. Stuff like that. Follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. Although I've been told I'm much more abrasive on Twitter than I am on the radio. Which is kind of hard for me to fathom, but yeah, I don't know. You might not like Twitter me. But anyway, at Scott Horton Show. And let me see here. Other things I should tell you. Oh, yeah. Retweet me for crying out loud. Thanks. Okay. Oh, yeah. So here's the other things that I got to say. I really suck at the business end of doing this show. Any of you guys who are regular listeners to this show probably are already under that impression and ain't got to be told. But if you noticed, all kinds of your favorite organizations did big fundraisers leading up to the end of the year there. LouRockwell.com did a big fundraiser there. The Future Freedom Foundation did a big fundraiser. Of course, KPFK kicked me off the air for 2 weeks so they could raise some extra money there for the station in L.A., and that's just how business is done. That's how it's got to be done, at least in my end, the libertarian movement. There's some who are getting their fundraising drive kicked off now with the beginning of the year. My problem is I never really put the focus on the fundraising stuff until I'm starving or, you know, the rent is late. And then I think, oh, God, I got to do it. And then I do. But so that's a crappy way to do business. That's not how it's supposed to be. So I'll just encourage you all to sign up for monthly subscriptions. I get donations. There's one guy that signed up for a monthly subscription of $1 a week. That's cool with me. You know, if I wake up in the morning and it says, hey, you got a bunch of things that came in overnight and it's a bunch of fives. Well, hey, a bunch of fives. Haven't you ever done multiplication tables before, man? That can add up to quite a bit. So the $5, $10, $20 donations, those go a long way toward the cost of living and the cost of the expenses of doing the show. On the other hand, I'm about to do a big Kickstarter campaign to raise money to hire a guy to put all the archives, 3,600-something interviews up on YouTube. And it's got to take, it does, believe me, I've been through this talking with a lot of people for a long time. It takes a level 25 genius to be able to write the code to, you know, be able to go through, make sure all the links work, first of all, get them all transferred to video format, uploaded with the descriptions and the dates and the titles correct and all this kind of thing. This is a significant project, and I got a guy who found a guy who can do it for such a reasonable price, you probably won't believe it. That's coming soon, the Kickstarter for that. And then also I was talking with Sneaker about the server last night, and the bad news there is that they're raising the price of our storage and bandwidth, and the servers are junk. They are old, donated junk, and they just, we need new RAM, we need new hard drives, we need, I don't know if we need new motherboards, or I don't know all about servers, but we need to spend hundreds of dollars on server crap, according to Sneaker, so, hey, that's just how it is. And honestly, like, I got most of this old crap is still fine. But occasionally I need to improve the audio equipment here. These external sound cards, I think, have about had it. Maybe one or two of them have. Need replacing. So anyway, the show ain't free to do. It also, of course, takes up time that I could be doing other things and making more money. So part of the deal of doing this show is bugging you guys for donations. If you want to sign up, go to scotthorton.org/donate or scotthorton.org/support, and you can sign up. The easiest way to do it is the PayPal monthly subscription kind of thing if you want to do it that way. There's also a regular snail mail address there if you want to send a check. I'll happily take those. And any single payments, you know, there's a guy who I went back and checked in the emails. He sends $50 at the end of every year. Once a year, he sends $50. That's perfectly fine. Those kind of single donations are absolutely great, and they certainly really help as well. And so you can get all that done at scotthorton.org/donate, scotthorton.org/support, either one of those. I'm trying to replace one with the other, but I just haven't talked to Dave in a couple of months now. I need to get with him about some webmastery stuff. But anyway, and then I actually have a couple of pretty positive prospects for advertisers, but they're not quite nailed down yet. But I certainly need them. I got some great advertisers. I need more great advertisers. So if you have any kind of peace group or any kind of libertarian group, or if you have a business or you work at one, you think that maybe your boss might be interested in help and support this kind of thing, just go again to scotthorton.org/support or scotthorton.org/donate, and it'll say right there my email address. It's just scott@scotthorton.org. Shoot me an email, see if we can work something out, and I'll cut you some spots, and it'll be great. Oh, and I charge very little. I'm trying to do that whole multiplication thing where, you know, a decent price times a few is enough. That's basically all I'm going for here, you know? So I'll give you a good deal, and I'll talk about your stuff, and then, you know, you'll give me money back and on the other side, and it'll be great. Again, that's scott@scott. Oh, whoa. Almost choked on my pretzel. That's scott@scotthorton.org right there if you want to advertise on the show. And by the way, more good news. You know how they're rerunning all my, not all, but many of my interviews at Voices of Liberty, Ron Paul's project. They're also fixing to start do this. They're fixing to start doing the same thing. I don't know how I lost. I dropped not just the G, but the N off the do there. That's also what they're fixing to do over at liberty.me. They're going to run all the interviews. Fixing to be doing. Over there at liberty.me, they're going to be running the interview feed there, so that should be good. I'm into that. All right, so what time is it? Oh, good, I got a couple of minutes. So let me tell you, I'll go ahead and remind you. My sponsors are, first and foremost, the great Mike Swanson, author of The War State and author of a ton of great investment advice at WallStreetWindow.com. You got some savings. You want to figure out how to protect it. Go to WallStreetWindow.com. The guy really knows his stuff. And you want to read about the early history, the rise of the modern New Right military-industrial complex after World War II, and their relationship with their presidents, the presidents. That's The War State by Michael Swanson. Then, of course, is Phil Giraldi's group, excellent group, the Council for the National Interest, which supports a pro-American, anti-anybody-else foreign policy, talking about you, Israel. There's Chris Braswell, who wrote the book Pizza Noir, book one and two. Jeez, I got to cut him a new spot. I owe him a new spot for book two there. Darren. From darrenscoffee.com. You guys drink coffee, right? I mean, how the hell else are you up before noon if you don't drink coffee? So he sells coffee, good coffee, really good coffee, and he's really into supporting this show. So he's willing to give free shipping, not $2 off, free shipping to any order with the promo code Scott there at darrenscoffee.com. Liberty stickers and thebumpersticker.com, of course, Go Kart Galaxy, and out of time. We'll be right back in just a sec. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, so let me just finish up about the sponsors there real quick. Of course, you heard right after I was done talking there, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. They are a sponsor of the show, as well as Whole Food Multi-Complete Vitamins. They're sponsoring the show. And then also I got deals going with audibletrial.com if you want to sign up for an audiobook there, liberty.me if you want to be my friend, sign up for liberty.me. It's just $5 a month now to join up for liberty.me. My Heroes Think, busts of Murray Rothbard, Harry Brown, Ron Paul. They're really nice. I got the Harry Brown one, and I think they're really great, and they're affordable. And that's myheroesthink.com. And then, of course, Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, where he gives you the lowdown on real economics and foreign policy in case you went to a government school and you wish you'd gotten an actual education. Well, Tom Woods is Tom Woods. That's at libertyclassroom.com. So I really shouldn't fight with these mainstream warmonger types on Twitter, because there just ain't enough room on Twitter for people to understand each other. And I like just ridiculing the hell out of trolls. That's okay. But when it comes to trying to argue with some lady from foreignpolicy.com, it just isn't a very good venue. But anyway, it may just be that I am a problem, you know. So, hey, look, somebody just signed up for the monthly donation for $5 a month. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate that. Those really help. All right, good. So what comes after the Islamic State is defeated is the new article at foreignpolicy.com, and it says that, well, the Americans are going to have to go back. Obviously, they're already going back to defeat the Islamic State. But then after that, yeah, it's going to be maybe problematic for the Americans to stay forever. But somebody's going to have to stay forever. So maybe it should be United Nations peacekeeping blue helmet forces or whatever. Which is funny because back in 2003, I thought that was the real motive of the war anyway, was to turn the country over to the UN and set the precedent for you know, the U.S. leading the way to crush the last of the rogue states and force them into the U.N. system, only because I was wrong. But now this is supposedly like, oh, I don't know, this is the best we can come up with, says the genius at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. I guess this is what we're going to have to do. Somebody is going to have to occupy the place forever in order to, the way they put it is something, it's right here at the beginning if I can find it. Okay, so even if U.S. and Iraqi forces defeat the militant group, preventing a disintegration of Iraq along sectarian and religious lines may require a long-term presence of U.S. forces. And then later on they exchange that out for, well, okay, maybe it would be U.N. forces instead. But he says, here's the guy from WinEp, James Jeffrey. Even if they're promised the moon, only if we have a presence will the Kurds and Sunnis buy into a Baghdad that's dominated by the Shiites and indirectly by Iran. But why should that be so? If Sunnistan has accepted the tribal leaders and more or less the Sunni population of Anbar province and then, you know, up toward Mosul, if they have accepted this compromise, rule with the Islamic State, at least for now, have declared independence and declared war in such a spectacular fashion, why should anyone believe that if the Americans defeated the Islamic State and were then, I don't know, what, standing around, that would somehow get the Kurds and the Sunnis to, quote, buy into a Baghdad that is dominated by the Shiite parties. Again, as I mention almost every day on this show, dominated by the Shiite parties because Bush already fought an 8-year war for them to kick all the Sunnis out and turn the government over to the Dawa Party and the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq. And so, in other words, Iraq is over. Iraq is over. Now, there can be a Kurdish-Shia alliance, and the Kurds, at American insistence, have remained, you know, legally speaking, on paper, within the Iraqi system, but they're cutting all their own oil deals. They're cutting all their own arms deals with the Americans. They've been an autonomous state since 1991 under American protection, and they are still part of Iraq in name only and for politics only, because being an absolutely outright declared independent Kurdistan raises all kind of problems for them in their relationship with all the neighboring states, and that's a crisis that those are a series of crises that they would rather put off. The Kurdish crisis in Iran, Syria, Turkey, and maybe even up to including in Armenia and Azerbaijan. So that's too much for them to bite off and chew now, and they know it. But is Sunnistan ever coming under the authority? I mean, it's not even right to say buy back into it. They haven't been part of the Iraqi government since they were overthrown and kicked out of power in 2003. And anyway, I don't know, man. And then so I get into Lara Jake. She's, I guess, an editor at Foreign Policy. And I get into this argument, but, you know, and it's my fault because I say, oh, if you're for war, you go sign up and fight and blah, 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 which is important, I think, and I do hate. And I do encourage the guy that wrote this to go get shot over there. Although I would hate to see him getting shot. Shooting others. But if he's going to sit here and warmonger in the pages of Foreign Policy about how Americans must occupy the place because Winnep says so, in order to prevent this from ever happening again, we're going to have to occupy the place indefinitely. I think anybody writing that ought to go ahead and leave their family, join the army, and go and put their testicles where their mouth is. That is the signature injury of the IED war, you understand. Young men losing their genitals to roadside homemade landmines. At least in Afghanistan, I guess, because after the MRAPs and stuff, they had a little bit better armor than when Rumsfeld was sending them out there to patrol in aluminum Humvees, you know, where they would just die. In Afghanistan, no, they're just maimed in the most horrible fashion and then live. But that's not the point. See, that's a diversion from the real point. No, I mean, it is a point. What, 19-year-old American kids are supposed to go stand around and get shot over there for what? For my freedom or some crap? So that the Islamic State isn't replaced with the next version of the Islamic State when they ever leave? In 200 years? It's madness.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Rad. I got Kelly Vlahos on the line. Hi, Kelly. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Kelly Vlahos, everybody, she writes for the American Conservative Magazine, and she would still write for Antiwar.com, but she just don't have the time no more, to all of our detriment, unfortunately. But what a great piece you did here for the American Conservative, theamericanconservative.com. The article is called Afghanistan's Still Broken Government. Thank you for caring enough to even pay attention to what is going on over there so that you can explain it to the rest of us, because everybody else packed up with the quote-unquote end of the war, or maybe 2-3 years ago, everybody else quit caring to pay any attention at all. So thank you for even doing this, and especially coming on the show to talk about it, too.
Sure.
Okay, so the Kerry-brokered Afghan power-sharing agreement hasn't resolved any problems or appointed any ministers. So please remind us about this power-sharing agreement, first of all.
Yeah, sure. Okay, there was an election last year, 2014, to replace outgoing President Karzai. The first round found that Abdullah, who is the former finance minister of Afghanistan, and a Tajik was in the lead, but he didn't have the 50% threshold to win outright. So a runoff took place. Now, most of his opponents were Pashtun. So what happened there was Ashraf Ghani, who is a Western-style official, he had been within the Karzai government, but then left because he couldn't take the corruption and went to work for the World Bank. And so he's had a lot of experience outside of Afghanistan in terms of working on development plans at the UN, and the World Bank came back to run for office. He emerged as the front runner in the runoff. He, after the first tallies, came to light, turned out he was winning by like 56% to 43% for Abdullah, and had just about declared the winner when Abdullah cried fraud and said he would not accept the results. He was pretty much ready to rip apart the government at that point if there wasn't an audit, which is very understandable since these elections are typically riddled by fraud. During the Karzai years, every election there was rampant fraud. So it wasn't surprising that these questions were raised, but the people I talked to figured that there was probably a lot of fraud going on both sides. But what happened was, as this audit was going on, there was a movement towards perhaps brokering a power-sharing agreement between both men to sort of keep the tensions and the possibility of there being, a real break in the government between the ethnic factions and the tribal factions, of which they run very deep there in Afghanistan, and Ashraf Ghani being a Pashtun, and Abdullah being a primarily Tajik, though his mother is Pashtun, really threatened to really rip the government apart. So John Kerry, Secretary of State John Kerry, helped to broker this power-sharing deal. It was in the works before the audit was even finished. Well, by the end of the summer, The International Election Committee that was overseeing the audit said that Ashraf Ghani had emerged as a winner, though they never told us how much he won by. We never got the final tallies. But upon hearing this, or the announcement of his winning, they signed the power-sharing agreement anyway. From what I understand, that it was heavily pushed by the U.S. government. So they signed this agreement, which was hailed as, a progress, in which 25 of the ministries would be split evenly between the selection. Each man would be able to select, half of the ministries. Ashraf Ghani would be declared president, and Abdullah declared the CEO, which in effect is a prime minister's role. What has happened is that they haven't been able to agree on who gets which ministry and who fills them. In the meantime, Karzai's ministry has, all his ministry leaders have been dismissed. So there's really no working government in Afghanistan right now, because these two men have not been able to come to any agreement. And we have a government there already in Afghanistan, a history of rampant fraud, corruption, nepotism, patronage. It is a Byzantine government built not on merit and not on experience, but on tribal relationships and politics, and hand washing and all that. As you can imagine, Ghani has come in saying he wants to clean all that up, and from what I have heard and people I've talked to that have worked with him or know him or have interviewed him have said that he's pretty earnest about that, and coming from a more Western style sort of system and approach, I think he really does believe that he is the guy that can come in and clean up all of the mess that's been left over from the war and the Taliban and all of the, the stain of the corruption. But now that there is this power-sharing agreement in which you have Abdullah, who's really a kind of an overhang of the Karzai administration in respect that he was in the government since the fall of the Taliban in 9/11 and truly benefited from all of the aid and all of the infusion of Western dollars there. And, people I know that have worked with him, believe that he really enjoyed that role. I don't know how much, how much reform is going to take place when you have him fighting for his place and for his people and Ghani fighting for his place and his people. And so it's become a sort of national joke that they don't have a cabinet yet, so which doesn't bode well for bringing this country into the 21st century and keeping it safe from the Taliban, which is always at the door.
Well, it's funny because it just sounds like you're describing American democracy, only without all the marble and flags and stuff for people to believe in. But just,
yeah, exactly.
Hey, this is the wheeling and dealing and how business is done. But so, and I mean, obviously, America pays the entire bills for the entire state. There is no state in Afghanistan whatsoever without the American taxpayer. So the whole thing is pretty much fanciful. But as far as it goes anyway, did these guys even like each other at all? I mean, can they have a deal where at least, the two of them, and I guess you just answered this with the fact that they can't even put a cabinet together. Can they not sit down and go, oh, yeah, you know what? You can have this as long as my guys get that and actually work something out like mobsters do sometimes?
Well, I mean, if you read the account in like the New York Times, for example, you have their spokespeople are constantly saying, yes, we are sitting down. We are coming to a point where we can announce a cabinet. We are getting to the point where we're going to start announcing names, and then it never happens. So I would imagine from the folks that I have talked to who are a lot more learned in, Afghan politics than I am, that the tribal competition and the tribal factionism in that country is so deep and it's so complicated that, unlike the United States, which, have all of our flaws and problems, they are dealing with a situation where it's completely new. And they have to basically tear down the whole system to build it again for it not to
now,
be
I'm
as
sorry,
corrupted.
Kelly. I got to interrupt and hold you right there. We'll be right back, everybody, after this break with the great Kelly Vlahos from the American Conservative magazine, theamericanconservative.com.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the show. I'm talking with Kelly Vlahos. You came up on the show the other day, Kelly, where I was talking with this British civilian advisor to the Surge and Hellman kind of thing. And I was saying,
yeah,
but we all knew the Surge was bogus before it started. I mean, Kelly Vlahos, et cetera, et cetera, right? And he talked about how, oh, yeah, no, we didn't know anything. We didn't know what would or wouldn't work. We didn't know nothing at all. He didn't even know about Britain's wars and how the Pashtuns most famous Alamo against the British was about 6 miles down the road from where their new base was, and how much this meant to the local population. Just completely clueless until Gene McKenzie clued him in on it, this kind of thing. But anyway, so that's the running joke on this show, is that, you know, this basically pirate radio turned internet radio nothing show is where we get the work done that never happens anywhere in D.C. or London or the ministry of this, that, or anything that matters at all.
Yeah.
They just go ahead and they do their war. They don't read the American Conservative. They really believe in this stuff that we just think they're lying when they tell us, you know. Oh, yeah, the surge. Well, it worked in Iraq. It's going to work in Afghanistan.
Right,
and
right,
we're laughing
exactly.
And they believe it.
Yeah.
Crazy. All right. Well, so, yeah, speaking of the surge working, so what about this? You're talking about the difficulty in them putting together this new government in Afghanistan, the ridiculous kind of nature of the compromise that Kerry came up with here and how it's just not working. Well, what about the resistance, a.k.a. the Taliban, but also the Haqqanis and basically any Pashtun with a rifle anywhere? I don't know if there's much of a resistance outside of the Pashtun community, but they're 60% of the country, right? So, they claim the war is over, but they've left how many tens of thousands of troops behind? And are they enough to keep the insurgency at bay? What is the situation with the war, Kelly?
Well, I mean, don't think that the Taliban isn't watching everything that's been going on with this government in Kabul. I mean, just today there was a story in which the Taliban has been tweeting, you know, mercilessly mocking the fact that there is no government and there's no cabinet right now. So, I mean, they've shifted from, you know, bragging about killing people to making jokes about the cabinet. They have stepped up their attacks on civilians. I mean, the civilian death toll in comparison with just a few years ago, I mean, is up. I think it was, I saw a figure of like 3,100 civilians died in the last year, and that's up from, I think, you know, 2,500 just a few years ago. And injuries from, you know, suicide bombings and other attacks are up. The security situation is dire. The poverty is up. The fact that you had touched upon just a few minutes ago about how we have basically created the economy there in Afghanistan over the last decade. But as the economy and as the war has been in transition with us leaving, you can see all of the effects that balloon, that, you know, constricting balloon is having. So the economic vitality is no longer there. So production is down. There's no new businesses starting. You know, the schools, you know, kids aren't going to school anymore. You know, all of the effects of the money, the spigot being turned off, is showing. So poverty is rising. You know, the economic indicators are flagging. The security is worse, and we're leaving. So we're leaving a country in just as bad a spot it was when we came in, except for the one difference is that the Taliban is not in charge. But we don't know how long it will be until the Taliban makes more aggressive moves into Kabul. Right now, Kabul is like a ghost town in comparison to what it was just a few years ago when it was, you know, it was thriving with Western money and Western people, Westerners there working, you know, journalists were there. You know, it was thriving, maybe not as, you know, by our standards, but I just read a piece in the Washington Post just a few weeks ago about a woman, you know, a woman, a Westerner who has been working there for the last several years, and she said, this is the grimmest, creepiest, you know, Christmas holiday that I've ever spent in Afghanistan because the whole place is shut down. People are terrified.
Like,
Westerners are gone.
It's just like Austrian economics. And in fact, it's all Federal Reserve phony money in the first place. But instead of a bubble in housing or a bubble in the stock market, it's a bubble in the power of the people over there who are chosen or figure out the best way to cozy up to the occupation to get their hands on the money, to get their hands on the guns, to get, you know, to have outsized influence. But it's all necessarily a malinvestment that did not come from real savings by real people who have the interest on the ground there. So it's a bubble that's destined to pop. And then, like you're saying, we don't know if it's gonna how long it's gonna take to turn back into the situation it was on September 10th, 2001, when the Northern Alliance was on the verge of complete and total defeat, and Osama had just suicide bombed their leader on the day before the 9/11 attack. You know, we don't know exactly how long it'll take to crash all the way to the bottom, but we do know that it's basically, they haven't even really tried to do what they said they were going to do, which was kind of build this government up, hold and build and employ the Afghans in the ruling of their own country in this, 21st century Western European nation state democratic kind of a way. They never even really tried to do that at all. They just pass a bunch of money out to a bunch of cronies in Kabul, like you're saying. Living in giant mansions and stuff.
And we know now in retrospect, but I mean, you and I and people have been watching with a critical eye, had known this all the time, but they weren't monitoring the money. The money was just going through a sieve. You know, all of the effort and time and energy was put into building up this military, which no longer can afford itself, you know, without Western assistance. And like you said, the government was never built up outside of this corrupt structure that I had spoken of. So the money, like you said, it was just, you know, you just throw a bunch of money at these people and it disappeared down a rabbit hole. And now all the Westerners are leaving, so you don't even have the, the conceit of there being Western trainers and people assisting and consulting. They're all gone. And so a lot of the projects that had been set up with our money are going to just fall down, sort of like, you know, fritter away and become sort of like ghost-like structures like in Iraq when we built up a lot of things. And then they couldn't sustain it after we left. And that's what's happening already in Afghanistan. We built up a lot, and now we're leaving, and they can't afford to keep these things up and without outside assistance.
All right, so are we leaving? I mean, that's news to me, if that's really true.
I mean,
obviously, it's not 2010 anymore, but what is it?
Well, we got about, I guess they're leaving 5,000 troops. Maybe, I can't figure out, Obama had announced, I think, right before the Christmas holiday that they were going to add another additional 1,000 troops to stay behind. So I don't know if it's 5,000 or if they're 6,000. But it's 6,000 U.S. troops added to perhaps another 6,000 international NATO forces. So it'll be about, at the highest would be about 12,000 Western troops will be left behind, which is just a fraction. And, you know, all I can envision is that would be good for, you know, guarding the embassies and bases. I mean, I just don't see how they're going to do much. And they're supposed to train and, you know, act as in an advisory role, but I really don't know how much real security those Western troops are going to provide. Meanwhile, there's about 350,000 Afghan troops, but they've been so embattled with all sorts of issues in terms of, you know, they're not getting paid, they go off on leave and never come back. They've sustained, you know, casualties over the years that aren't even reported in the U.S. media anymore. But, you know, they've been really hurt by all, you know, they talk about how the U.S. casualties have gone down, but the Afghan casualties have gone through the roof. So there's a lot of problems with the forces themselves. I just read a story where they don't even know that, you know, the new president Ghani got rid of all of the forces that were protecting the bases because he didn't trust them. So now they're building up a whole new force just to guard the bases, and they're asking us to pay for it. So there's not a lot of trust in their security being able to hold any areas that they managed to get, you know.
It's going to be like the helicopters fleeing the roof of the Saigon embassy here for too long, I think.
Unfortunately.
They got enough soldiers there to get shot, but not enough to protect themselves. That's a hell of a thing.
Right.
All right, I'm sorry we're out of time. Thanks so much for your time, Kelly.
Well, thank you for having me.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, hey, I'm Scott. It's my show. Oh, man, I need to hit the button here. I'm doing too many things at once, trying to do a live radio show and typing an email and making a Skype call and babbling into a microphone and watching Fox News. Oh, God. All right. Well, I'm all right, though. I'm going to put the email aside for a minute, and I'm going to turn away from Fox News for sanity's sake, and I'm going to introduce our friend Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst for 27 years. He's now the co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. What they do is they write letters, open letters, to public officials saying, no, no, you're wrong, and the horrible thing that you're doing is horrible and will cause terrible consequences. And then it's all signed by a bunch of former CIA officers and former military intelligence officers and former FBI agents and that kind of thing. Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Also, he has his own website, which is raymcgovern.com, and he writes for Robert Perry over there at consortiumnews.com, where, you know, they win the Scott Horton Award at Consortium News, certainly for their coverage of the Ukraine crisis and America's relationship with Russia over the last year, better than anything at The Nation or anywhere else, and especially on a consistency basis there. The great Bob Perry, no matter what he says about us libertarians, the great Bob Perry and our friend Ray McGovern and their great coverage of Ukraine over there. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Ray?
Thank you, Scott. Doing well. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, too. Very happy to have you back on the show again. And so your most recent piece here is called Rebuilding the Obama-Putin Trust, and goes along with, like I just mentioned, many other articles along these same lines, especially over the past year here. But I guess to get right to the point, we're going to have to get to the history first. Can you tell us as briefly as you can you state the case for what it is that you believe transpired last February 21st, 22nd in the regime change or the change of government, however, I don't want to prejudice it, the end of the presidency of the last guy there in Ukraine leading up to the current controversy?
Yeah, Yanukovych was deposed by a coup led by neo-fascist groups. On the 22nd of February, a day after an international agreement had been worked out with the Ukrainian authorities, whereby Yanukovych, the president, would leave early, there would be early elections, and everything seemed to be on track. Now, all of a sudden, there were snipers shooting at both sides of the people on Maidan Square, and we had the invasion of the federal offices and the president's building and the Congress there, and Western legend, eaten up by the New York Times, Washington Post, everybody else, is that Yanukovych fled. You know, he left. He disappeared. This was a classic coup d'état. As a matter of fact, the president of Stratfor, no left-wing organization that, I said that this is the most blatant coup that in the history of mankind. It had been advertised on YouTube 3 weeks before, so most people know that story. In any case, that was the proximate cause of why the people out in the eastern, southeastern part of Ukraine didn't want any part of this coup government, which, as I say, was pushed into power largely by pro-Nazi forces who are fighting the what are called, this is important, what are called pro-Russian separatists out there. Well, they're not pro-Russian separatists. They're anti-coup federalists. Big difference. They don't like the fact that their duly constituted elected president was removed in a coup arranged by the United States and the EC, and they're not about to submit to them. Now, has Russia encouraged them in this? They needed no encouragement. What they did need is some political and some military support. Let's face it. But, you know, what the Western version starts out with, and I encounter this all the time as I do interviews with places like the BBC.
Say, all right, Mr. McGovern, now, how do you feel about Russian aggression and Putin seizing the Crimea?
Right, and I say, well, you know, why do you start at the seventh inning here?
Well, what do you mean, sir?
I said, well, you know, this all started, approximately at least, with the coup d'etat. The coup d'etat in Kiev, orchestrated openly by our State Department, and Putin. Putin had no idea. There's not one scintilla of evidence that Putin and his friends there had any idea of reincorporating the Crimea into Russia proper until the coup. And that forced their hand. So people can't start with the seizing and quote of Crimea. They need to start with the background. And there's even more background, as you know. We've talked about it before. The whole business about the U.S. and NATO violating their pledge, their promise to Gorbachev and Shevardnadze way back in 1990, that NATO would not move, quote, one inch eastward, end quote, toward the Soviet Union at the time and toward Russia. And as we know by now, there have been 14 new states joining NATO, all of them to the east of East Germany. So that's the earlier cause. After 25 years, that's still great. So the question arises in Putin and other people's minds, why do they need to do this? What are they really after? And that's the question that needs to be resolved this year.
Right. Well, and I hate to divert off onto this, but it is important, and it can't always go without saying, but it usually does when we talk about this stuff. So the responsibility of the American people for listening, I mean, not that they've really supported the policy or whatever, but they tend to buy these stories hook, line, and sinker, no matter how many times we get hit with this. It's not like the last time this happened, it was Lyndon Johnson lied to us about the Gulf of Tonkin, right? We've had this over and over and over again, where whatever it is that they say about what's going on is never true. I mean, the North Korea Sony hack is the one from, you know, the most recent one, where there's really no reason to believe North Korea has anything to do with it whatsoever, at least that we've heard so far. But they won't let that stop them on TV. And according to the polls, or at least according to what the TV claims the polls say, Ray, 75% of the American people are willing to snap too and say, yeah, let's get North Korea. They're the enemy. They're out to get us. Oh, yeah, no, the evil Vladimir Putin is on the march. He wants to recreate the Russian Empire. He's an aggressor. And what's America going to do to contain his aggression? TV said so. Even after Iraq, even after Libya, even after all these things. So it seems like there's a responsibility at some point on the adults of this society to really put their foot down and say no more to this. And to say, no, we just don't believe you. Whatever it is that you're claiming is just a claim to us. And whoever it is that you're accusing is presumed innocent by us because you guys are liars and killers. I mean, what are we even talking about?
Well, Scott, you put your finger on it, and since this is a new year, I'll say what I've said every year for the last 12, that I've seen a lot of change in Washington in 50 years, but by far the most significant change, by far, is the fact that we no longer have, in any real sense, a free media. That is big. So the fourth estate is dead. Now, the good news is there's a fifth estate, and we're speaking on it now. Young people are much more attuned to the fifth estate, and so we have to find ways to get grown-up people, old as I am or almost as old as I am, to tune in to where they can get real news. That is a formidable challenge, and I think we're making progress, but it's slow. You can't hold the American people innocent for avoiding these kinds of things. But you can say, well, given the economics of the situation here among most Americans, you know, they have one or two jobs, they come home, they feed the kids, they put their feet up, and they don't want to go into consortiumnews.com. They want Fox News, and they think they're getting news from that. Right. That doesn't excuse them, but it explains an awful
right.
lot.
Yeah, I think so, too. Yeah, James Fallows has this thing in The Atlantic, mostly blaming the American people and letting the government off the hook, and they're the ones who are, you know, the actual politicians in charge are the ones. But anyway, I'm sorry, we got to take this break. We'll be right back with the great Ray McGovern in just one sec, y'all.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. I'm talking with Ray McGovern here. Veteran intelligence professional for sanity and writer at consortiumnews.com. Check out his website, raymcgovern.com, as well. And we're talking about America's relationship with Russia. And I'm sorry, I got us all off diverted on the media and the American people and this and that and whatever, Ray. And I would get straight back to what you were saying about the relationship of Eastern Ukraine and the West and the American role, except that I think right when we were going out to break, you were trying to say one more thing there were interrupted. So if you wanted to wrap up one more point about the American people and the foreign policy here.
Well, I think pretty much I said it. It's a terribly unfortunate situation when the American people can't learn the truth. I guess I was going to adduce the worst example ever. John Mearsheimer, preeminent political professor, political science professor at University of Chicago, widely respected. He writes this article in Foreign Affairs, and they print it, and it says the U.S. is responsible for the troubles in Ukraine. And it lays out all the evidence. Now,
Foreign Affairs being the Journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, the most prestigious think tank for 100 years running now in New York.
You're provoking me. Okay. Well, anyhow, you know, they did print it. And I asked John, I said, John, did you get any reaction to that? He said, oh, well, yeah, phone ran off the hook. But, you know, Ray, it was French TV. It was Italian. It was another. I didn't get a reaction from any of the outlets here in the States. I emailed him back, said, John, is that unusual when you're speaking out on a very current sort of very topical issue? He said, you know, Ray, come think of it. Yeah, I never answered something like this before. So there you go. I mean, here he succeeds in writing this thing. The editor of Foreign Affairs, to his credit, puts it in their magazine. It is the preeminent whatever it is. And nobody comments on it. Nobody mentions it, not even on MSNBC. And so it sort of dies a natural death. Now, if that were highlighted, if the American people knew the facts in that article, they would know that the Ukrainian situation is not a matter of Putin trying to get back the Soviet Union or, you know, invading the Ukraine and threatening NATO, that it's a much more complicated affair, and that it's really a function of the neocons who are in charge of our foreign policy, and I include John Kerry, the Secretary of State, in that, really smarting from their failed attempt to get a war started between the U.S. and Syria back in September of last year, 2013, okay? They were right on the verge. The Israeli air defenses were up. The French fighter bombers were on the tarmac warming up, and Obama changed his mind. Now, he changed his mind because he found out that those so-called chemical attacks by the government of Syria were not that at all, that the sarin used was not from Syrian government stocks. It was homemade. Almost certainly it came from the rebels who were trying to mousetrap Obama with full cooperation from the neocons into starting this war on the pretext that the Syrian government had violated the red line that they had persuaded Obama to set. So they were really angry about that. I was up on the top of CNN headquarters there doing an interview with BBC International the night after, and Wolfowitz Lieberman and all those guys, I never saw them so down in the mouth. They didn't get their war. Now, how could they retaliate move up their preparations for the coup in Ukraine. And that's exactly what happened. Putin's involved in the Olympics down there in Sochi. When he gets back from the Olympics, all of a sudden, the Maidan is in flames and the coup happens. And that's what forced him to act, of course. You know, the main naval base, their only warm water naval base since Catherine the Great at the time of our revolution is in Crimea. And Putin is not about, or no Russian leader is about to even risk the remote chance that Ukraine would join NATO. And as he said in a sort of jocular way, he said, you know, I'd hate to see a situation where our armed forces would have to be visiting the NATO naval base in Sevastopol, Crimea. I'd much rather have it the way it is now, where they're happy, we're happy to have them visit our naval base in Sevastopol, you know?
Isn't he such a raving, fanatic lunatic, that Putin, with his deadpan humor and his little, you know, we considered it and we thought, actually, we would rather invite you guys to be our guests instead.
Well, you know, he's kept his cool through all this. And, you know, right after he, pulled Obama's chestnuts out of the fire, you know, he was going to do this war on Syria. It would be bedlam, even worse bedlam there than it is now. And Putin said, hey, Barack, remember we talked about this at the summit in Northern Ireland? We've brought the Syrians around. I think they're willing to destroy all their chemical weapons. Obama says, really? He says, yeah. Now, Kerry, he's cut out of all this. He says that same day,
they will never give up their weapons. That's never going to happen. Never give up their chemical weapons. Okay.
What happens? Within 4 days, the chemical treaty was signed, and now all those Syrian chemical weapons were destroyed. Now, that should make the neocons happy, because that was Syria's major deterrent to an attack from Israel. But no, it enraged them because it removed the pretext for war. And so what I'm saying here is that they were going to get even. And this is not the only motivation, but you can see Victoria Nuland handing out chocolate chip cookies to get the sugar level up on the Maidan, and openly talking, or not openly, but the intercepted conversation with the ambassador in Kiev, where she says, yeah, Yats is our guy. The others can wait in the wings. Yats knows about the economics here. He knows what the IMF will require. He's our guy. And sure enough, I was really shocked at this. 3 weeks later, I wake up in the morning, 23rd of February, and guess what? There's been a coup in Ukraine, and who's the new prime minister? Yats! Yatsenyuk, okay? So I wrote a little article saying, yikes!
Right, and it's not even like the leak came out later. The leak came out before the regime change, and then they still did it exactly like in the script.
Yeah, so the revolution may not be televised, Scott, but this coup was YouTubized. My God, you know.
And then the leaders of the NSA said, how dare the Russians spy on our diplomatic phone calls?
Oh, it was an open line, for God's sake.
The good news is I don't have a third guest today, so I'm going to ask you politely, and you're going to graciously offer to stay one more segment with us to talk more about this subject, because we're not done yet, are we?
Okay,
good. It's Ray McGovern, everybody. He's at consortiumnews.com. And him and Bob Perry, they're the dynamic duo over there on, first of all, the matter of the Syrian chemical weapons incident of 2013, and then most especially their coverage of the coup in Ukraine, the use of the Nazis by the American side there, the Russian reaction, the aftermath, and setting the record straight. For the last year and change there, consortiumnews.com. It's the great Ray McGovern, and we'll be right back with more right after this. Thanks for staying on, Ray. Mm-hmm. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. Okay, me again. Scott Horton here. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, scotthorton.org for the archives. Talking with the great Ray McGovern from consortiumnews.com and raymcgovern.com. former CIA analyst, specialist on the Soviet Union back in the day, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we're talking about the aftermath of the American-backed coup d'etat of February last year and using real, no-fooling Hitler-loving Nazis to seize the buildings, drive the president out of the Capitol. And some of the leaders of those Nazi groups have actually made it into the parliament now. So it's not like they were just sort of the lowest brown shirt auxiliaries. They are part of the leaders of the new government there, these Nazis. And then, as Ray put it before, the people in the East who had, you know, supported and won the election and had supported the previous president, they decided they weren't going to put up with that any more than Texans would support it if a bunch of communists seized power in Washington, D.C. or something like that. They would probably go for the fascists, but you know what I mean. Anyway, point being that here we are in this mess. And as you were before the break and we were interrupted there, Ray, you were at the part where the neocons were really mad at Russia for saving the American people from getting into another war, this time with Syria in August of 2013 over the sarin hoax there, which it turned out was really Jabhat al-Nusra that did it with help from the Turks. Then they decided, well, we're going to get back at Putin. Maybe more to the point, we're going to get back at Obama for working with Putin. We're going to make sure that that kind of catastrophe doesn't happen again by finding a way to drive a further wedge between the United States and Russia. And they picked Ukraine as their lowest hanging fruit to be their target to hit next. Is that your conviction of the real motivation for the coup in the first place?
Yeah, that's not the exclusive motivation, but it's the lion's share of it, Scott. There are also, you know, the mega corporations, the international ones that covet Ukraine for its very real natural resources, the black earth and other resources, and would love to have a cheap supply of cheap labor coming on into the EC to help them, you know, develop their own economies. So make a Greece out of Ukraine, which is where it seems to be headed, if something doesn't intervene. But you know what I'd like to do is just kind of speak a little bit out of my experience. I was chief of the Soviet foreign policy branch in CIA way back when, and I've followed Russia and the Soviet Union ever since my degrees in academe.
You were the chief of it, huh? I guess I never realized that.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll tell you a secret. Now, this is not to go outside this room, right, Scott?
All right.
Bobby Gates worked for me.
Oh, I already knew that.
Yeah, yeah. He worked for me for 2 years, 70 to 72. And when I wrote his fitness report, I mentioned that he was reasonably bright, but his ill-concealed ambition was a disruptive influence in the branch, and that unless he sort of cut it back, he was going to be trouble for everybody. Little did I know. And I wrote that, you know. And so people said to me later, 10 years later, when Bobby Gates became head of all analysis, Ray, I bet you regret being so frank in that fitness report. I don't regret a word of it. Look what happened. We're all working for that scoundrel, and we were. Anyhow, that's a diversion. But I do know something about Russia and the Soviet Union, and it was almost kind of it was fun is the wrong word, but it was kind of good for me to get back in the game when I saw what was happening with Ukraine. Now, we get all these reports by so-called journalists, which talk to the State Department people and others, and think they get these scoops about what the Russians are really after. But in those days, we had to rely about 90% for our source information on open media. And there was this subdiscipline of political science called media analysis. It was a no-brainer. You read really carefully what the Russians, or in those days the Soviets, were saying, and you looked for changes in what they were saying. Or you just looked to see, well, could they really believe what they... I remember going to my boss, you know, as a really young analyst, I said, you know, I think the Russians are really afraid of the Germans. I don't think it's just propaganda. He put his feet up on the desk, looked up at the fluorescent lights and says, Ray, you're telling me the lights are on, okay? So you learn a lot. Now, if you just look at Russian media and you just read, you know, nobody reads anymore. You read Putin's speeches.
Here's what he said, for example, right after the coup in Ukraine. He said, you know, where is it here? Our Western partners, you know, they continue to interfere in the Ukraine. I sometimes get the feeling that somewhere across that huge puddle in America, that people sit in a lab and conduct experiments as if with rats without actually understanding the consequences of what they're doing. Why do they need to do this? He's talking, of course, about the coup. And then he says, look, it's bad enough what they're doing, but the deployment of a missile defense system is the worst. Now, you may recall that Obama, in an unintentionally overheard conversation with Medvedev, who was president of Russia at the time, right before Obama was reelected, Medvedev is saying, look, you don't need an anti-ballistic missile system in Europe. Why? There's not a threat from us, much less from Iran. Why do you do that? North Korea, give me a break. And Obama says, and it's overheard. He says, well, you know, give me some space. So let me get reelected first, and then we deal with this. Well, he's unable to deal with this. And the important thing is that the Russians believe that he is a captive of the military-industrial complex and the security state. And he doesn't have the freedom to do the kinds of things even that he did with respect to Syria in bowing to the pressure to stop the war and being given an out by Putin. So that's big. If the Russians really think that Obama, who I believe they think is the most sensible person around, although extremely malleable and susceptible of all kinds of crazy ideas, if he at least senses that, for example, a missile defense system is not what's needed to cause even more tensions in Europe, and he's unable to deliver on that, which, you know, that was 2012, right? So what, it's over two years now. The Russians, what are they going to do? Are they going to sit around and let U.S. Newly fitted out naval ships with anti-ballistic missile systems crowd into the Black Sea and the Baltic and in Central Europe and endanger what has always been the Russians' strategic weapons deterrent? Are they going to do that? Well, no, they're going to do everything they can to prevent that. But failing preventing that, what does that leave? That leaves launch on warning. That's kind of a trade phrase to say as soon as the Russians suspect that the Americans are up to something really, really, really strategically important, they are going to be tempted to launch their deterrent on warning. And we're being the situation that we were before 1972, when those strategic arms limitations treaties were signed. I was in Moscow at 72 at the time. Nixon came. It was a big deal, and it kept this balance of terror until the end of the Cold War. Who wants to reintroduce this balance of terror?
So I'll wait, you're
the
saying
people make money out of it.
You're saying that this. When Kissinger says this would be a tragedy if we get back into full-scale Cold War, this is what he's talking about, is a situation that he helped undo with the detente of the 1970s. But you're saying it's been since then. Reagan didn't even undo that during his brinksmanship in the 80s and abandoning of detente. They still didn't. He didn't ratchet up the situation so that they were back to launch on warning again. It's been since when? The early 70s, you say? Oh,
well,
man.
Yeah,
music.
Of course we
Ray,
have.
Ray, stay another segment with me, would you?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as long as we're going, right? The rest of this news will have to wait till tomorrow. Boy, do I have Israel news for you guys, too. But I'll see if I can get a good guest to help cover it. Did you see the one about Naftali Bennett in the Jerusalem Post today, Ray? Check that out during the break. We'll be right back, y'all. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe.
Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back. I got the great Ray McGovern on the line, talking about Russia. So, I'm sorry, I'm terrible at watching this clock, Ray. Did I understand you right there about the launch on warning thing that you were saying it's been since the early 70s since the Russians had such an itchy trigger finger on their H-bombs?
Yeah. Well, Scott, it's really pretty simple, and of course, when you're as old as I am, you remember these things, especially since I was deeply involved in them. The strategic equation was really, really very labile, as the Germans say, very itsy-kitsy. And it was decided that we, the CIA, could monitor the deployment of Soviet missiles and Soviet air defense, missile defense systems, okay? So when we proved to Reagan that, when he said, doverai, no proverai, trust, but also verify, we said, okay, Mr. President, we can verify. And so he took that aboard, went to talk to Gorbachev, who the honest ones of us Russian analysts at the time told everyone who would listen was the real deal, despite what Bobby Gates and Casey were saying about the Communist Party of the Soviet Union never disappearing, never giving up power, okay? And they negotiated with Gorbachev. And that's, of course, how right after the Berlin Wall fell, George H.W. Bush was able to say, look, the dream that I portrayed in my speech in Mainz earlier this spring can be true. We can have a Europe whole and free from Portugal to the Urals. Let's invite Russia in. Let's get this thing set up so that there's a security system to cover all of Europe. Now, as we know, Clinton and others went back on that. But the thing is that the strategic thing had always been pretty solid until, of course, George Bush revoked the key agreement. And that was a treaty signed in May of 1972. As I say, I was there. It was a treaty called the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, and it limited each side to two sites to have an anti-ballistic missile system, and pretty soon that became one site. And what did that end up doing? That ended up saying that neither side could count on immunity were they to launch a first strike, because there would be no way to prevent a second strike, because they would have no viable nationwide anti-missile system. Now, what's happening now is, as the Russians see it, and anyone in their position would see it, this is a canard that Iran is a threat to the United States, and the same with North Korea. If they're going to fire missiles at us, it's not going to be over Europe. And so the missile system that the military and the corporations want to build is designed against Russia. That's pure and simple. And Obama seemed to recognize that when he told Medvedev, back in 2012, we'll talk about this, but first let me get reelected and give me some space until I get reelected. Well, there's been two years plus space. No. So how can they trust us? That's the big thing. How can Putin look at the history since the fall of the Berlin Wall? Look at what Obama has had to acquiesce in, because he's got no guts and because the military and the security services are running this country. And just ask yourself, now, if you were Putin, you would keep your cool for as long as you could. But if they keep building these systems, and if they, worse still, start to incite a regular war in Ukraine, well, all bets are off, because he has the high cards there. He's not going to launch any ballistic missiles at us, but he is going to be very, very firm in defending what he sees and what most reasonable people would see, I would add, as Russian national security interests in that part of the world where the U.S. has very questionable national security interests.
Oh, sorry, mic was off. And so now Obama and the Republicans are given hundreds of millions of dollars more in military aid to the Kiev government to help them continue waging war against the people in the east. And they're on again, off again, ceasefires. But, I mean, is it as simple as if Kiev is ready to win outright over the Luhansk and Donetsk resistance, whatever you call them, that the Russians will absolutely be guaranteed to intervene there militarily?
That's correct.
And I don't mean little green men, but I mean a real invasion.
They will prevent those parts of the Ukraine from being folded back under a repressive regime such as is now existing in Kiev. You can bet your bottom dollar on that. Now, what they've tried to do is work out arrangements where things would be short on that. In other words, these eastern provinces could be, well, the Russians really want, they don't want to do what they did with respect to Crimea, to the eastern provinces. They don't want them, and the eastern provinces don't want to become part of Russia. So there is the makings of a deal. The problem is that egged on by Congress and the military-industrial complex and the corporations to make a lot of money out of tensions in this part of Europe, that Obama is playing that kind of game, and he's telling Yaroshenko, the new prime minister, president, he's saying, go ahead, you know, give him a bloody nose. And I don't think that Obama or anybody he has working for him in the State Department or in the White House knows diddly about war is what really like, and Putin does. And that's why I see him as being less inflammatory, less provocative, but when push comes to shove, that's his part of the world. He's not going to let these Ukrainian folks, less still the ones headed by neo-fascists, prevail in that part of the Ukraine.
All right, well, so, well, I don't know. A couple of things here. First of all, I want to give a little bit of credit to a guy named Klaus Erich, who has warned about the missile defense system and the push against Russia, forcing them into the position of moving back to a launch on warning position. He has made that comment on virtually every interview I've ever posted on antiwar.com or on my own website for a decade now. And his point is, this is the only thing that matters in the whole world, okay? That America and Russia don't have an H-bomb war. It's the only thing that matters. Nothing else matters compared to that. And you know, he's right about that. It's something we should talk about, and I'm happy to, you know, point out that he's really done a great job of beat me over the head about that. Not so much of a good job of getting me to cover it as much as he would like, but he's certainly right about that. But then, so, I mean, what the hell is the strategy here, Ray? I know, domestic politics and whatever, but why are the Americans giving military aid to the Kiev government when it looks like that could help them provoke this? I mean, we're not talking chess. We're talking checkers here. They push that far, then no king me, and instead a worse war. Come on.
Well, Congress is one of the major flies in the ointment here. They have no idea what fire they're playing with. They do have lots of ideas how they stay in power. They stay in power because they appropriate money for the military-industrial complex, security complex, and that money is spent on weapons and so forth, and a slice of that money comes back into their coffers, and they get reelected, and so they appropriate more money. It's that simple. There are, you know, pecuniary elements with a major role here. The other thing is that since they don't know really what kind of fire they're playing with, it's very, very popular to blame everything on Putin. He's the big bad guy. The major media reinforce that. And so unless Obama can seize the bull by the horns, and I suggest at the end of my latest piece, he needs to fire Kerry and Nuland. That would speak volumes to everybody in the world that realizes what's really at play here. Now, can he do that? I don't care whether he do that or not, but he should realize that Putin, the president of Russia, called Kerry a liar. Now, he called him a liar 5 days before Obama arrived in St. Petersburg for a summit. Now, why did he do that? because Kerry lied to the U.S. Congress 2 days before. He said the moderate rebels are winning in Syria. Nobody believed that. And then he repeated this canard about Bashar al-Assad being responsible for the chemical warfare stuff, or these chemical attacks outside Damascus on August 21, 2013. So Putin said, I was really taken with this because I've never seen this happen before. He says, "On vriot, on znayet, što vriot, это печальня," which means he's lying. He knows that he's lying. This is really sad. Now, so if Kerry is still given his head here, and he gives in turn the power to Nuland and others to create more mischief, there is no telling what they might be intent, what they might try to provoke. Hopefully, saner minds will prevail. But if I were Putin, I'd be looking around for saner minds in this country, and I'd be hard pressed to find any. So that's why I say this is going to be a crucial year for this overreaching, this transcendent reality that the strategic equation is in danger of changing in a way that has not been since 1972, when we had a treaty that prevented any side thinking that they could launch a first strike.
Right. Okay. Now, as long as we're over time, and we are, but hell, I want to ask you this. It's really important. What about Belarus? And what about Russia itself? Of course, right around the time of the start of the Maidan protests in the fall of 2013, you had this essay in a series of threats, basically, in the Washington Post by a guy named Gershman, who I think Carl Gershman, the head of USAID, which is just the CIA's outsourced, soft, color-coded regime change operation, basically,
yeah,
right?
The National Endowment for Democracy.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you for the correction. Yes, the NED. And I'm not exactly sure what the difference is in their roles. If you want to clarify that, I'd like to hear it. But he was saying, yeah, and maybe you're next, Putin, is how the thing ends. If he doesn't like it, maybe he'll find himself in the same position there in Moscow. And I wonder whether you think that's really on the agenda for Kerry and Nuland and the coming Jeb Bush administration.
Well, Nuland famously
playing with fire there, you know.
They are, and this is doubtless in the calculations of Putin. Think about it. Here's Nuland openly bragging that we have, as she said, devoted $5 billion—that's billion with a B—dollars to satisfying Ukraine's aspirations to become part of the West. End quote. Whoa. $5 billion. You know how many, fascists you can buy with $5 billion?
Yeah, quite a few.
Now, she wasn't talking the previous year. She's talking, she worked on regime change and building democratic structures for Iraq. Can you imagine? Under Dick Cheney. So she's got a lot of experience in all this. And when she said $5 billion, she knows what she was talking about. Now think about Putin. And now he's hearing from one of the funnels for all this money, the National Endowment for Democracy, called Gershman. He's hearing that, you better watch out because the next, after the Maidan, then comes the Red Square, and you gotta, watch out because this is going to happen to you. Well, the big thing here, in my view, Scott, is this, that if you want to stop, if you're really authentically concerned about stopping more oppression in Russia, putting the Russians back to the security state they used to be, the way to guarantee that is to threaten them the way we're doing right now, to stir up things in Ukraine, to make sure that the relations between Russia and America are as bad as they can be. And that gives Putin not only the pretext, but gives him ample reason to clamp down in a way that he probably wouldn't if he hadn't felt so threatened. So this is one of the major realities when people say, oh, yeah, well, you don't say anything about Putin's repression, Well, all right, there's only so much time. But in a very real sense, part of this repression is directly due to the external threat, which is as real as it is imagined, given what's happened in the Ukraine.
Yep. Where is the health of the state? That's why his poll numbers are so high right now. Same happens everywhere. That's why people support the Ayatollahs in Iran. That's why Fidel Castro's remained in power for so long. Is, you know, what better foil than to go up against the American Empire?
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Ray. I've already kept you way, way over today, but I sure do appreciate it.
You're most welcome, Scott. Have a good new year.
You too. All right, y'all. That's the great Ray McGovern. He's at consortiumnews.com and raymcgovern.com. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.